Sprinkles and patchy morning fog. Today's high 39. Some winds up to 30 miles per hour. Right now, there are some sprinkles all around us. Wind southwest at 15, gusting to 28, 39 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Happy to be speaking for the next few minutes with an award-winning investigative reporter, editor, newspaper publisher, actually also a screenwriter and movie producer, and now a novelist, thanks to his new book, The Hunt for the Peggy Sea, a World War II maritime thriller. I'm speaking with John Wynn Miller, and his novel, which is, I believe, his first, is set in World War II, as the subtitle says, but it tells the story of World War II and the peril faced on the seas from kind of an uncommon perspective and through the eyes of, in a sense, very ordinary sailors, not actually part of the military at all at this point in time, since this novel is set before America's entry into the Second World War. It's incredibly suspenseful and also eye-opening because it just gives us a sense of how those who were traveling the seas just delivering goods were, in a sense, facing exactly the same sort of peril that was faced by those who were in various national navies at a time, of course, when Nazi U-boats were such a dangerous presence on the high seas. It's a fascinating book and really well written. It's published by Bancroft Press, again titled The Hunt for the Peggy Sea, a World War II maritime thriller. And John Wynn Miller, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
I touched on in that brief biography of you that you have written in all kinds of different formats and genres and so on. First of all, was that always your intention, or is that just kind of the way life has worked out, that you have had all kinds of different opportunities and a wide array of different arenas to write?
My whole career has been almost accidental. Back many years ago, when I entered college, I wanted to write the great American novel, or at least a novel, but I realized, one, I didn't know how to write, and two, I had nothing interesting to write about. So I got into the student newspaper and journalism, and from there ended up being a foreign correspondent, an investigative reporter, an editor, a publisher, none of which was planned. So, but with each step, I learned a different way of writing. As a journalist, you write, you know, the facts, ma'am. And as a screenwriter, it's more like haiku. It's a very sparse description. It's all focused on what the reader can see. Very crisp dialogue. And then when I decided to write the novel, finally, it's totally different because you've got multiple points of view. You've got to describe all five senses, got interior thoughts. So it was something I'd always wanted to do. It just took me four decades to get around to doing it.
Did anything in particular prompt you to write this particular novel, that is, to craft this particular story?
I had been a huge fan of World War II stories and TV shows and novels, but that's not the reason I'm writing about it. The people ask me, why did you decide to write about World War II? Well, I didn't pick it. It picked me. True story. Many years ago, my daughter Allison and I were watching a really bad action-adventure movie. I don't even remember what it was. And I kept telling her, I know I can write a better screenplay than that. And that night, I had a dream. And when I woke up the next day, I knew the first scene of the screenplay, I knew the last scene, and I knew the name of the ship, the Peggy Sea. And that was it. I had no background on U-boats. I've never been on one, never been on a tramp steamer, and had never been to most of the places I wrote about.
You also mention in the author's note or acknowledgments, I forget what you call it, at the very end of the book, something about the COVID-19 pandemic and the fact that when that sort of descended upon all of us and you, like so many people, found yourself essentially stranded at home for long periods of time, it sounds like that was crucial in terms of you being able to actually sit down and get this this novel finally written.
Yeah, it was because we were stuck at home with my two standard poodles, my wife Margot and our Maine Coon cat. I decided, you know, it's time. I'm old enough. I need to write that novel if I'm ever going to do it. So I took an online course and I read a bunch of books on how to do novels as opposed to screenplays, which I'd written. And so I sat down and just started writing. But I also had to do tons of research about the period, about submarines, about ships, about nautical terms, all of which I knew nothing about. So when I sat down to write it, I was surprised myself, and I finished the first draft in 7 months, which I never thought I would get done.
Before we dig into the story itself a bit, I would be really curious to know what you regard as the single most important difference between writing a screenplay and writing a novel. Obviously, they are very different. But for you, in terms of actually doing the writing of this novel, what was maybe the most significant, ever-present, and maybe challenging difference between the two exploits?
Well, with the screenplay, again, you're focused on the action. You're just what you can see. So you don't have to give a lot of explanation of how things actually work or worry about getting the terminology exactly right because you don't use a lot of it. But when you're writing a novel, everything you write has to be researched, and you also have to give the backstory on the characters, and you have to build a more complete picture of who they are so they're not stereotypical Nazis or sailors or tough guys. So that was the hardest part was with novels, you've just got endless possibilities. With screenplays, it's kind of formulaic, and it was a little bit easier to write.
We're speaking with John Windmiller, and we're talking about his new novel, which is also his first novel, titled The Hunt for the Peggy Sea, a World War II maritime thriller. So this is a story set during the early years of the Second World War, as I said, before the United States has officially entered the conflict as an active official and public participant.
Yeah.
But one of the choices you have made is to tell this World War II story in a sense through largely civilian eyes, aboard not an aircraft carrier or a battleship, but rather primarily aboard what I think we call a tramp steamer. First of all, explain what that term means, what kind of a boat we are talking about in general, and then more specifically about the Peggy Sea, of course, who is in a sense, the title character of your novel.
Yeah. Well, a tramp steamer is a cargo ship that travels from port to port without any particular itinerary. They go to each port, dropping off their load and then hunting for a new load to carry somewhere else. So they're kind of itinerant travelers, and they're civilian crews that usually come from the dregs of society who can't succeed on much of anything, including crime in some cases. So, and the captain of the ship is Jake Rogers, and so he's got this motley crew that turns out that they're actually make most of their money from smuggling.
So it's so interesting. You've in a sense crafted a novel in which our main characters, who are in some respects heroes, are by no means stereotypical heroes. I mean, they aren't dressed entirely in white, if you know what I mean.
No, it's all grays. And you know, what the story revolves around an American fugitive who's struggling to outrun a Nazi U-boat captain bent on revenge and outsmart the mutinous crew of his own cargo ship to rescue a Jewish family that he doesn't know from Amsterdam. And he does it first for money, because he's a smuggler, and then for love, because he falls in love with the oldest daughter of the family. And so it's really a love story wrapped in an action adventure, although there's tons of action. And when I was pitching it as a movie, I would pitch it as, well, it's Casablanca meets Das Boot.
Hmm. That's well put. I can really sense elements of both. There's a short little line very early in the book that I think is worth talking about. And that is, I think, when they are talking about the challenge of finding a load, finding their next load, as you were talking about. I mean, this is that kind of an enterprise in which you don't know where that next load is going to be or where that load is supposed to be taken and so on. And I think it is a character in kind of talking about that uncertainty about what they're going to be doing next says, or thinks to themselves, the damn war was changing everything. And I think a lot of times when we think about kind of a momentous point in our history, like 1938, 1939, we tend to think about it in the most momentous of terms. And I think one of the things your book does so well in the early going is kind of also reminds us that part of a moment like that in our history is just that disconcerting sense that so many things are changing. And the way we did things even a very short time ago, suddenly that doesn't work anymore. It's like there are completely different rules by which we have to operate, and rules that maybe are not of our own making or rules that we might not fully understand. Explain how that was especially true with these tramp steamers in the late 1930s, how their life was changing in such drastic fashion.
Well, the ship, the Peggy C, it's an American ship, and America hasn't entered the war, so they're still neutral. But with the U-boats trying to destroy Britain by cutting off all supplies to the island nation, even neutral ships were in some danger because they could be in the middle of a battle at nighttime and get sunk by accident, maybe. And so they had to learn how to operate in dangerous waters that might have mines in them, that they might be attacked at any time by a ship by either side who couldn't recognize them, although most of them would travel with big lights on their side so you could see the American flag. And it got harder and harder to pick up any kind of load other than smuggling, which put them in even more danger because the Germans would frequently stop neutral ships and search them. So if they got caught doing that, it could be really serious. So they had to be take a lot of risk and hope for a good reward, but usually it wasn't very much. And in this case, they were offered a huge amount of money to smuggle this family.
Hmm. And, of course, that is something that puts this crew of the Peggy C in very, very grave danger. I think early in the book, the adjective you use to describe the crew of the Peggy C is ragtag. And at one point, in describing the challenge of Captain Jake Rogers in leading such a crew, we read these words at one point. He was aware that it took iron discipline to keep in line a crew of often ill-educated, shiftless vagabonds who became sailors after failing at everything else, including, in some cases, a life of crime. You'd kind of touched on that earlier as well. I mean, this is so far from what we often think of in terms of a finely tuned crew of a very able seaman. The crew of the Peggy C is a rougher group in a lot of different ways. Explain just how ragtag this particular crew is in your novel and how much fun it was for you to, in a sense, shape them as characters.
Well, they're an international crew. He picks up whoever he can find, and he doesn't find really enough to run the ship the way it should be run. So it's a small crew. He recruits them from the worst parts of the towns. Whoever needs to get out of a town and come work on his ship. And they're not particularly honorable. They're not particularly well educated, and they're easily influenced by rabble rousers. So when they discover, they didn't realize he was going to smuggle a Jewish family, and they get really upset about that, because if you're smuggling cigarettes or booze or, you know, other things like that, the Germans, you know, they'll be upset, but they're not going to kill you like they are if you're smuggling a Jewish family. So Jake, the Captain Rogers, has to juggle getting away from the German U-boat that's chasing him and maintaining discipline among the crew. And it's a lot of real tension and mixed loyalties there.
As you touched on earlier in the interview, you did a lot of research to acquaint yourself with kind of what life would be like on such a ship. And you also did a great deal of research when it comes to U-boats and how they functioned and what it was like to serve aboard them. And I feel like I learned so much about life aboard Nazi U-boats, including the whole matter of where the typical crewman on such a ship, what their attitude would be, where their loyalties would be. And you tell us at one point that on the typical U-boat, most of the submarine crews thought of themselves as above politics. I mean, and they weren't, in a sense, aboard that U-boat and conducting themselves with anything political on their minds really at all. Tell us more about the mindset of those who manned these U-boats and what life aboard them was like.
Well, they were considered the elite because they were also most likely to get killed in the German military. And they really were a team that were almost more loyal to their captain and their crew than they were to anybody else. And they believed that they were doing their duty for their country and were more apolitical than typical. Now, the captain of the ship, Victor Brouwer, is political. He is a Nazi. He's not a typical Nazi. I didn't want my characters to be stereotypical. So there's some ambiguity. He's a Nazi, but he thinks he's doing God's will. He's a self-made man who worked his way up to the Merchant Marines to become a lawyer and then become a captain. So all of the crew, again, I wanted to present a more realistic picture of a complicated characters than which they were, not meaning that they were good or that they did good things, but they thought they were doing the right thing. Hmm.
There are all kinds of wonderful little nuggets of information scattered throughout the book, and one of my favorites is how on a U-boat, when it was time to prepare the torpedoes and to deploy them, that the word fire would never be used. You don't say fire the torpedoes. Explain why you don't, what the problem would be with doing so.
Well, it's funny because it's one of the reasons why I was careful not to watch movies about U-boats, because they would say fire. But you never said the word fire on a U-boat because that meant it's on fire. And so everyone had to run and try to find the fire and put it out. So what they would say is torpedoes los, L-O-S, which means torpedoes away. That way it was clear what they actually meant and didn't create a panic when they were getting in the middle of a firefight.
It's such an interesting thing that, you know, I think not ever occurred to any of the rest of us in terms of what might be going on. I wanted to ask you about something else when you're talking about the various members of the, again, the ragtag crew of the Peggy C. At one point, a distinction gets shared, and it's this: a deck officer is a profession, an engineer is just a trade. And I think a lot of us more carelessly kind of assume that, you know, everybody aboard such a ship are all, in a sense, figuratively, you know, pulling on the same oars, and, you know, we're all in this together and so on. And you're speaking to a more complicated picture, especially aboard a ship like the Peggy C. What are you getting at there with that moment?
Well, it's actually true that there were certain feelings of differences between the deck crew and the engineering crew, which would be below deck in the engine room and in the boiler room, and that one was more of a profession. It's like little cliques. It's just like high school on these ships. But it could have dangerous implications because of the way they thought about each other. And I had to do tons of research on that. I read a bunch of books. I watched videos. I read diaries. I even went so far as to read the diaries of U-boat captains. They're online. And I did that so I would know what the phase of the moon was for each day of the trip. I wanted it to be that accurate. And wow. And then I had a former submarine officer, an American, who's a novelist, read it to make sure that I got the terminology did accurately. And he made some changes that were really wonderful that I never would have known about.
Interesting. Do you can you share maybe one of those with us?
Yeah, like when you watch movies, you'll see the captain gives an order, and the sailor will go, "Aye, aye, captain." Well, you don't always say "aye, aye." You only say "aye, aye" when he's giving a non-standard order, meaning he's not telling you helm 30 degrees to port. When he's just telling you one thing, you say "aye, captain," is yes. But when he's giving you an order, non-standard order, you're saying "aye, aye," because that means yes, I understand and I will comply. Hmm. So, I mean, I never guessed that.
I didn't either. Last quick question. You have inserted into the course of this novel all kinds of little historical facts about this period, about this time. And for people who really know this history well, those will be like little bits of buried treasure. Maybe give us one example and explain why you have done that.
Yeah, every time I was doing research, I kept going, what? I didn't know that. And I read a lot. So one of the little jewels that I discovered was that when Britain won the Battle of Britain, the air fight against the Luftwaffe, the head of the Royal Air Force said publicly that there are three reasons why we won. One was because of the bravery of the pilots. Two was because of the Rolls-Royce Merlin engines. And three was because we had suitable fuel. I went, what? What's he talking about? Well, it turns out that after Dunkirk, the Americans had developed, Standard Oil and Sun Oil had developed a new type of jet fuel or engine fuel for planes. And it became known as BAM 100, British Air Ministry 100. It was 100 octane fuel, which allowed the British planes, when the battle started, to fly 35 or so miles faster than they had over Dunkirk. They could climb and shoot and move around so fast that the Nazis were stunned. They had no idea that the Brits could do that. And so they tried to develop it, but they couldn't because they operated on 87-octane fuel, which came from coal gasification, and they didn't have oil. So when I read that, I said, I've got to figure out a way to get that in the plot. And it does play kind of a key role, and I won't explain why, but it was just one of those fun things that I kept running into. Like, you know, Hitler had pirates. There were other things like that.
It really just deepens the just how fascinating this book ultimately is. Fascinating and indeed exciting. The book again is The Hunt for the Peggy Sea, a World War II maritime thriller published by Bancroft Press and the author John Wynn Miller. John Wynn Miller, congratulations on a really marvelous first novel, and we hope that there are going to be more of them that you will share with the world. But in the meantime, congratulations on this terrific book, and thanks for being my morning show guest today.
Thanks. That was a wonderful interview. One of you that had actually read a lot of it, so that's good.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program is an interview from the Morning Show archives, recorded and initially broadcast way back in 2002. Enjoy. Philip Gerard will be a familiar name to many of you, particularly to those of you that listen to us in the afternoon, to NPR's All Things Considered. He contributes frequently to that program. He has done a number of documentaries for PBS, is the author of a number of different books, most recently a book that is really extraordinary, which takes us into a chapter of the Second World War that will be completely unknown to basically all of us. The book is called Secret Soldiers: How a Troop of American Artists, Designers, and Sonic Wizards Won World War II's Battle of Deception Against the Germans. And Philip Gerard joins us for a few minutes on the morning show to talk about his book, Secret Soldiers, published by Plume Book. Philip Gerard, we welcome you to the program.
My great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
In a nutshell, tell us what Secret Soldiers is about.
Secret Soldiers tells the story of about 1,100 very special guys, artists and designers and actors and so forth, who were recruited and combined into a unit unlike any the U.S. Army had before or since. Their mission was a very simple one: to deceive the Germans about when and where American and Allied armies would attack between D-Day and the final crossing of the Rhine River that led to the downfall of Germany. And they had a number of ways of doing this, but basically they were creating one big magic trick on the battlefield. These guys could make whole armies disappear. They could create phantom armored divisions, basically conjured out of radio traffic, what they called rubber duckies, which were blow-up neoprene dummies that resembled tanks and artillery pieces. actors who would infiltrate into places where collaborators were known to be and pretend to be releasing information that they shouldn't, and sound effects. They had a thing they called sonic deception, which basically meant they could broadcast high-fidelity sound for up to 15 miles across a battlefield and create the impression of just about anything they wanted in the minds of those people listening across the river in the dark or behind a screen of trees.
One of the things that you mention is the fact that this was done under an amazingly complete cloak of secrecy, and that the vast majority of U.S. soldiers, for instance, had no idea that these special troops existed or that they were even doing this work.
Right. This secrecy lasted well into the 1980s, and there were lots of good reasons for it. One reason is that deception most often is used out of weakness, and had we had all the armored divisions and all the infantry divisions that we needed throughout the Second World War, there would have been no reason to conjure them out of thin air. So you really don't want those guys in, you know, the 28th Infantry sleeping next to you to know that instead of the armored division, which they think is covering their left, in fact, you've got five half tracks and a bunch of loudspeakers and a bunch of kind of nerdy guys that came out of the University of Chicago or somewhere playing sound effects into the dark when there's a real, very real Panzer division sitting across the river licking its chops waiting for you, you know.
I suppose the whole enterprise loses its effectiveness completely if it isn't done in secret.
Right, although toward the end of the war, they began to get very clever, and at one point during the Battle of the Bulge, when they needed to get some relief to Bastogne, for instance, the planners in the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops, which is what the official name for these guys was, decided that they would try something really interesting. And what they decided to do was to take two divisions, the 4th Armored Division and the 80th Infantry Division, and divide them up and just simply make two of them. One of them was real, and one of them, of course, was fake, conjured solely out of radio traffic. They knew the Germans would know that one of them was fake, but they were counting on the fact that they had a 50% chance that the Germans would guess wrong, and in fact they did. The Germans followed the radio traffic instead of the real units. The real units ended up linking up with the beleaguered troops in Bastogne, and it's one of the untold stories of how that siege was actually lifted.
Of course, almost every bit of this story is an untold story in a sense.
Right.
And that's one of the things I want to ask you about before we probe into a few details. I think in the introduction you said that after all of this work of deception, which this special unit did, their last disappearing act was to vanish from history.
Right.
And indeed, as you say, all of this was cloaked in almost complete secrecy into, I think you said, the 1980s.
Well into the 80s, yeah.
First of all, when did that cloak eventually become lifted, and was it in any sort of conscious way? I mean, did someone finally make a sort of an official decision that now we may begin to talk about this in a more open fashion, or was their work more sort of discovered?
I think the declassification proceeded, as many times it does, by inches. That is, by the time it was declassified, pretty much anybody who knew anything about it in detail was long gone, of the people who had planned it, I mean, officers and people in the War Department. And so through very routine kinds of audits of what's in the archives, things began getting declassified as people began to ask for them. The first written account of this that I'm aware of that went into any detail was a magazine article that was illustrated by Arthur Shilstone in 1985 for Smithsonian. Shilstone, who worked for Smithsonian, was a very gifted artist, and he had been one of the members of this unit.
Mm.
And that was really the first and only, you know, peep out of this thing. So once I got to the archives, I realized there was a whole raft of paperwork that was now being declassified and was available, and also lots of stuff missing, lots of things that turned up only in the footlockers that some of these guys had brought home from the war, or in their diaries, letters, you know, other kinds of things that they had saved, which allowed me to piece together the story, and of course their wonderful interviews. They were very forthcoming in helping me to fill in the gaps.
I suppose that's one thing we should be really grateful for, is that you came along interested in this story at a time when, many of the principal participants, as you already said, are already gone, and the day will come when none of these men are alive anymore. And
certainly,
so,
one of my best informants was Colonel Clifford Simonson, who is, you know, at the ripe old age of 93, still going strong. And, he was one of those guys I found through an internet search, you know, cold calling people till I found a guy that would tell me about a guy who would tell me about a guy. And then I finally got to him, And this was, you know, late August and of 2000. And he said, geez, you know, come out to Colorado and see me and we'll talk. And he goes, better yet, we're having a reunion in 2 weeks. Why don't you meet us up there? And so I, you know, got on a plane to Watertown, New York, and met, you know, 30-some of these guys. And they were just remarkable. Mm. And it is true. They're older gentlemen now. The youngest at that point was 74. The oldest was Simonson. And most were in their 80s. Bill Blass, unfortunately, has already passed away since I've talked to him. He was one of the key members of the group as well.
Hmm. One of the things I appreciated about the book was that, you know, as we read this and we think to ourselves initially maybe, boy, this is incredible and unprecedented. I've never heard of anything like this. But time and time again through the book, we are reminded that the art of deception has been a part of warfare almost from the beginning. Give us some sense of that.
I think the first time that anybody attacked anybody else in the Stone Age, there were probably the next time they tried to attack, the person who had been attacked the first time tried some ruse in order to fool them and gain an advantage. Because that's really what it's all about. There are two great advantages to deception in warfare. One of them is that if you're weaker and you're either attacking or being attacked by a stronger force, it gives you an edge. And that was proved time and again in this war as in others. The other thing is that, and there's a very humane sense in which it does this, it helps you to limit casualties. That is, if you can attack a stronghold without having to go head-on with the enemy and slaughter people on both sides, but in some other way cleverly get them to surrender or cleverly get behind them, do some ruse and attack them in such a way that there's very few casualties, you actually can fight a much more humane kind of war. So one way of looking at this is that you know, these guys did a mission that was quite altruistic from a lot of points of view. Was altruistic in the sense that they were putting themselves on the line, literally making living decoys out of themselves, saying, here, come get us, while they pretended to be something they were not, which was, you know, 10,000 strong with tanks and guns. And on the other hand, what they were doing philosophically was trying to end the war with a lot less bloodshed, and I think they succeeded marvelously in both.
That's right. You give us actually two main purposes behind this, one of them being to minimize casualties. The other is really the essential thing here is the idea of turning weakness into strength,
right,
and of putting the underdog into a better position than they might otherwise be. And it's important maybe for us to remember that at least at certain points in the Second World War, in certain situations, that's exactly what we were.
Well, for a very long time, I mean, we have to remember that we didn't have an Allied victory until October of 1942 when Montgomery and Al Alamein in North Africa finally was able to defeat Rommel on the battlefield. And he did this through a magic trick. In fact, he had a magician named Jasper Meskelin working for him. And what they basically did was create a fake army on the southern flank by the use of decoys, by the use of radio traffic. They had created dummy soldiers, dummy railroad lines, and so forth. And then they actually, under cover of darkness and under cover of other kinds of camouflage, took an entire army and moved it to the northern flank, which is where they jumped off from, with great success. And Churchill recognized this in the House of Commons. I mean, it was a kind of turning point in modern warfare deception.
Incredible.
And it was the kind of the touchstone upon which all else was modeled.
It's interesting to me, actually, if we want to go back much earlier than that, I had not heard the story or don't remember hearing the story that dates back from our own war between the states and actually something which the Confederates did in trying to bluff Union General George McClellan,
right,
using something that I think you called Quaker guns.
Quaker guns.
Tell the story. This is great.
Deception works best when it's aimed at the decision maker on the enemy side. That is, you want to target that person that can actually change the outcome of the battle, and you want him to do something you want him to do rather than what's good for him. In this case, the Confederates knew that McClellan was a very timid general. He was very good on the parade ground, but they weren't sure, you know, in combat that he would stand up, and so what they did as he invaded Virginia and was on the road to Richmond was the Confederates cut down logs, painted them black, and stuck them in embrasures all along the roadway so that McClellan would wake up in the morning and his scouts would report cannons everywhere. And they weren't cannons, they were logs. But they understood their general, and they targeted that decision maker absolutely right on the money. And he saw those guns, pulled back, and said, I can't attack without massive reinforcements. And, of course, lost the initiative, and thereby Richmond held out until virtually the end of the war.
One more point which you make in the introduction, which I really think bears a bit of discussion. You say at one point, not all soldiers are fond of practicing deception. And you say that for many military personnel, this really runs entirely contrary to their basic instincts. And you go so far even to say that traditionally for American officers, secret soldiering of this kind carried a whiff of dishonor.
Yes.
Explain that a little further and how that, if it was, could be overcome.
Well, Cliff Simonson pointed this out to me. He was a West Point man, straight up and down, and he was given the task with this new unit of planning and showing them how to do what they were going to do, and he had no more clue about how to do this than I did as I started the book. And all he knew about soldiering was that the honorable thing to do is you charge at the enemy. You lead men in open battle, and that's the honorable thing. What he was being told to do was to lie not just to the enemy, but to his own superiors, to his own men on his own side, to do things that seemed like they were skulking and in some ways cowardly. You know, that this was not the war of the cavalry soldier riding into the glorious battle, the glorious charge. And there was a huge problem undoing that mindset among the West Point officers, many of whom were picked to command this unit. And what eventually happened was that Simonson, as he began the arduous work of trying to turn this unit into an operational reality, actually came to appreciate the subtleties of it. I mean, he was a man who was a quick study. He was open to new ideas in a way that many soldiers of his era perhaps were not. And what he began to do was to become creative. And after a while, he became the most ardent disciple for this kind of warfare, partly because it could save so many lives. And so like many converts, he became the most rabid supporter of this particular brand of warfare. And the other thing to remember is that the Geneva Convention says a lot about deception. And there's a fine line between what's called deception and what's called treachery. Deception is acceptable. You can pretend to have Quaker guns, as they did in the Confederate Army. You cannot surrender and under a flag of truce then suddenly pull out guns and begin shooting at your enemy after you've disarmed him. You know, you can't do those kinds. So there's a fine line, and there's lots of room for ethical sliding back and forth that these guys had to deal with.
Right. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because, of course, our military action in Iraq right now brings to mind that, you know, we're one to just draw comparisons in a very superficial sort of way. One might sort of think that some of these same principles are underway in Iraq in some of the incidents that we've heard of Iraqis surrendering and then having a concealed weapon and opening fire, or other cases in which military hardware will be hidden within the walls of a hospital or something
right.
like that.
All that stuff specifically forbidden by the Geneva Convention. You can't put troops, for example, in an ambulance painted with a red cross. You know, you're not allowed to dress your people in the uniform of your enemy, which both the Germans did in World War II and reportedly Saddam Hussein's Republican Guards did in the recent war.
So this is an utterly different kind of deception.
Right. And, you know, the other thing that should be said about the reluctance of those West Point officers was that there was very little chance for glory in this kind of a battle. I mean, if you're leading the 28th Infantry and you go through a bloody battle, at the end of it you all stand up, you pin your medals on, your picture's in the paper, and you get promoted. These guys, from the rank of captain on up, were in a dead zone for promotion. Nobody was ever going to know what they did. They couldn't leave the unit because they knew too much. They couldn't be promoted in the unit because there wasn't room for that many senior officers. And they weren't going to get the medals that they might have gotten. They weren't going to get the career boost they might have gotten. You know, Simonson should have probably been a 2- or 3-star general by the end of the war. As it was, he ended up as a colonel. So, you know, it was not the kind of way to make your reputation for the quick-rising, ambitious soldier from West Point.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today on The Morning Show with Philip Girard, who is the author of a fascinating book entitled Secret Soldiers, How a Troop of American Artists, Designers, and Sonic Wizards Won World War II's Battles of Deception against the Germans. One of the things that your title implies is that the Germans maybe had their own aspirations for such deception. Am I misreading your title, or were they in this game as well to some extent?
Well, sometimes you're in a battle and you don't know it. And I think sometimes the Germans were suspicious of being deceived, and yet again and again they made wrong decisions. The Germans actually had begun the war using massive deceptions. The way they went into Poland was based on a ruse, for example. They staged a mock attack on a radio station. They went into Russia in a surprise attack. They went into Norway dressed as tourists. But because they got very bold and very full of themselves, in fact, German doctrine all the way, almost until the end of the war, stated that any German attack would succeed for a specified amount of time, and that varied from a couple of days to a couple of weeks, because they were so confident in the overwhelming weight of their armor. In a sense, they lost the flexibility that they could have gotten through deception. On the one occasion that they did use it, they really mimicked what the Americans had done, and that was during the Battle of the Bulge. They hid two entire armies right under the nose of the Americans, and through radio traffic and camouflage and other kinds of diversionary movements, they convinced everybody, from Eisenhower on down, that they no longer had the ability or the materiel or the men to wage war. They convinced them they had no more airplanes. And then suddenly, just before Christmas in 1944, waves of Luftwaffe bombers are coming out of the skies. You know, two entire armies are swooping down through Belgium and Luxembourg. And these guys, by the way, were caught right in the middle of it. And were scrambling around in many ways, becoming real combat troops for the first time, other times scrambling to get their top-secret equipment out of the way of the advancing Germans, and then participated, as we've talked about, in the relief of Bastogne.
We learn a lot in the pages of this book, and one of the things I really appreciate is that we learn about things that we sort of thought we already knew about. For instance, the art of camouflage. And you go to considerable lengths to explain really the principles of camouflage and sort of the difference between, you know, doing it brilliantly well and doing it not so well. And it seems as though that's one chapter of this story, is how the art of camouflage really blossomed into something almost unprecedented in its sophistication.
Well, camouflage really is an art, I think, and it began with artists. It began with artist Henderson Theater in the beginning of the century, and then the French artists who were working with the camouflage corps in World War I really perfected this based on cubist and geometric designs, as well as the natural camouflage of birds in the wild and so forth. So there's an incredible history there. And what these guys did was have to take it to an almost postmodern stage in which you had to camouflage something, but you had to do it just inexpertly enough that it looked like it had been camouflaged for real, but in fact you had made a mistake that was deliberate in order that the Germans would actually see what's in effect not a real tank camouflaged, but a fake tank, a rubber blow-up tank camouflaged to look like it had been camouflaged. So there was a real kind of double blind going on there. Nowadays I understand that we have camouflage uniforms that actually can make infrared light not as sensitive to them and can hide soldiers from night vision goggles and things. So it's come a long way, and it probably has some more ways to go.
It's an incredible book, and we learn about the participation of all kinds of rather nameless figures, but also the contribution of important people like actor Douglas Fairbanks Jr., all told thrillingly and fascinatingly in this book called Secret Soldiers. Philip Gerard, I'm so grateful that you wrote this book, and I'm sure that all of the men and women perhaps that participated in this work are so grateful, too, that this book has been written and this story finally told.
Well, one of my great pleasures in doing the book was being able to meet these guys and also to help some of them meet other pals that they hadn't seen since the war, and I think they were dying to tell their story, and I felt privileged to be the one to be able to tell it.
Secret Soldiers is published by Plume. Philip Gerard, we thank you for your time.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's Richard Goldstein, a music critic, and we're going to be talking about his wonderful memoir called A Little Piece of My Heart. It is a look back at his experience as a music critic in the late 1960s and early 1970s. He was really one of the first music critics who really took rock music seriously, and his memoir is about that and much, much more. We had published in our schedule a,
a conversation that would air tomorrow with Ron Kronovich, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College. That interview is going to be airing next week instead. On Thursday, we look forward to the first monthly visit of 2023 from Nan Calvert. Her program on Thursday will center around Salt Awareness Week. And on Friday, you'll hear a conversation I'm about to record with a doctor from the Mayo Clinic